Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us on WILL AM, or if you're watching online, we are webcasting today's program. You can watch through our website. That's WILL.illinois.edu. This morning, we have another in a series of conversations that we have been having with candidates who will be competing in Illinois' March primary. And we will be talking with candidates both for the State House and also for Congress. This morning, in this hour of the show, our guest is Michael Fershing. He is one of three Republicans seeking their party's spot on the ballot in the new 13th Congressional District. It is a district that begins in and around Champaign-Urbana and then stretches southwest all the way to the Illinois-Missouri border and includes Decatur, part of Bloomington, Springfield, also Edwardsville and Taylorville, and a lot of small towns in between. There are three, as I say, there are three candidates who will be competing in the primary to represent the Republican Party in this race, and the others will also be on the show, and I do want to mention that Thursday at 11 o'clock, Tim Johnson will be with us. He's a Republican member of Congress. He's sort of the incumbent, even though we're talking about a new district here. He represents currently the 19th Congressional District. And also Frank Metzger will be with us on Friday at 11 o'clock. So you'll have the opportunity to see and to talk with all of the candidates. Just a little bit more about our guest, Mike Fershing. He attended Eastern Illinois University, University of Arizona, and Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville. And he is a graduate of the U of I College of Vet Medicine, and he practices as a veterinarian. He started in 1983 his own business. That's Fort Russell Veterinary Service. And he works on a variety of animals, large, small, and exotic, although most of his clients are dogs and cats. He has served on a number of public boards from 1997 until 2001. He was member of the Edwardsville School Board. He also served as trustee for the Holiday Shores Sanitary District, and also he was a member of the Madison County Regional School Board. And we're pleased to have him here in the studio with us. As we talk, questions from people who are listening are welcome. You can call 333-9455. Toll-free. We have a toll-free line that's 800-222-9455. Or you can send us an email if you'd like to do it that way. And the address is will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. Thank you very much for being here.
Well, it's sure nice to be here, David, to talk with you and, of course, with your listeners.
These days, we know that the approval ratings of Congress are pretty low, and we know that people are unhappy with Congress for what they perceive to be as political gridlock, inability to get things done. So if you were to be elected, you would be a brand new member of Congress and would have the opportunity to do things differently. What would you do to try to deal with that problem of gridlock and get things done?
I really am one of those unhappy voters, and that really is why I'm running, because I really think that the people we've been choosing for a good number of years are the wrong people. You mentioned you think people are unhappy because we're not getting things done. I also am unhappy by the things they do get done. I really think we've been selecting representatives in Washington who have been promising to give us advantage. They're going to attempt to please various little small special interest groups and say, yes, I'm going to make sure that your group gets this sort of thing from Washington and that sort of thing for Washington. And I really think we need to change our manner of selecting people. We really need to be making sure that we are electing people to Washington who are going to pay attention to the Constitution, who are going to protect our freedoms, not for what they're going to do for us. So really my running is not for trying to get things done. It's for stopping the federal government from doing too much.
Well, I'm sure that a lot of people would argue, including members of Congress, would argue that what they're there for is to try to, as you say, is to try to serve their constituents, provide some kind of benefits to the people that elected them. How do you balance that with perhaps some larger idea that what you're there is you're supposed to be doing something for the benefit of the entire country?
When you're balancing that, I weigh heavily that I'm supposed to be looking out for what's the best for the country. In other words, my primary reason to be elected as a congressman from this area is to make sure that the Constitution is followed, that the limited role the federal government is supposed to have, because we are supposed to have disseminated powers, that those principles are followed. If we continue to elect people who whose primary motivation in that balance is to provide benefits specifically to people in our district, I think we're going to continue to be going down the wrong road that we are on right now. The country is in huge trouble.
Well, let's talk some more about the role of government. How do you decide what is appropriate, what the government should be doing, and what is too much?
There's two ways to kind of answer. One is kind of the constitutional answer, but I really think it's better for me to answer on a personal basis. And it will sound somewhat constitutional, but personally, I think if you're structuring a government, government should have very few roles as far as how they can infringe upon us. In other words, regulations should be there to protect freedoms and protect free markets. And when it starts getting into the area of managing people or deciding what choices people should make, government's stepping over line. And specifically with the federal government, it really should be limited to the enumerated powers, for example. I really generally agree with that that's spelled out in the Constitution, saying that these are the specific roles and areas where the federal government can be involved. But the vast majority of those powers have been disseminated, and that's because if you disseminate power, the chances for overriding corruption and just distance between the voters and elected people is much less when you disseminate power instead of concentrating in one capital for the entire country.
Well, be very specific. Give me 2-3 things that the federal government is doing now that you would say the government should not do.
Commerce is the biggest area. In other words, the federal government should not be involved with commerce except for when there's disputes between states. But government shouldn't be involved on what drugs we buy or what health care we purchase. Those would be specific areas where it's really outside the purview that the federal government do. I think it's perfectly good to have regulations at a local level should a local level want those. But at a federal level, it really lumps too many people together and really diminishes personal choice.
You don't think that it's appropriate for the government to be involved in things like consumer safety?
No, I really don't. In other words, the areas where I think federal government, put it more in a category of government, because as you just heard, federal government shouldn't be involved at all in some regulations. Mm-hmm. But I think it's perfectly fine for the government to be involved in making sure people are not being dishonest. In other words, fraud, protection of property. Another area where that crosses over is pollution. I definitely think that government getting involved to protect people who've been damaged by pollution is really important. And also, I think it's important for government to regulate economic coercion. That's monopolies and oligopolies, where a small group can use their weight in the marketplace to control things. I think that there is a role for government in those areas. But as you mentioned with safety, I tend to think with safety, that's much more of a market value thing. If people have been damaged by problems, they can get compensation or people being outrageous. But as all regulation, it can go overboard. In other words, illustrate that, I'll talk about pollution. In other words, I really think it's appropriate for government to get into the area of pollution and protecting property. But we can go overboard when we start making rules to say, well, we think there's going to be pollution and damage, and so we're setting up rules and regulations for that. That commonly will get into a problem area because no damage has been done. There's not likely damage to be done, and there's many choices of how to prevent that damage. But government is stepping in and regulating, this is the only way which you can prevent it. And I think that's too invasive.
Mm. So you're okay with the idea of the government going after a polluter after the pollution has already occurred, but it sounds like you're saying you're not really sure whether there's a role for the government in trying to prevent pollution from happening in the first place.
Well, it's one of those things where there's not a hard set rule on it. In other words, there is fuzzy area. If someone is building a huge incendiary device in your yard and it's never gone off, well, the threat of having such a device to cause damage, i.e. pollution to your neighbors and surrounding areas, is too high. And that'd be an obvious time where I think, you know, pollution rules would kick in. But examples we've had recently, this has been reversed, but they had for milk farms that where they were collecting milk, they had to have containment systems in case there was a milk spill to prevent contamination of the soil. Well, I think this is a prime example of a huge overreap to illustrate the point where you can make rules in the name of regulation, but you're going way over the top. It's just it's too much interference in the marketplace.
Let me just quickly introduce again our guest, Michael Fershing. He's a candidate for Congress. He's one of three Republicans who will be competing in the Illinois primary here in just a couple of weeks. And we have asked the candidates to come and be with us on the program to respond to my questions, but not just mine, also to yours. So you have questions, comments, you can call in 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. I think that probably for a lot of people, they would say that if you ask them to list the things that they thought were big, important issues, the economy would probably be the number one or two thing on the list. What do you think that the government can do to try to stimulate the economy?
I actually think economics is the number one question by huge. We're looking to how are we going to correct our bankruptcy. We even though some people don't realize it yet, we've already accumulated so much debt. I don't think there's any way we can possibly pay it off. I don't think there's any intention to ever try to pay it off, and I think those are huge mistakes. We continue to spend money we don't have. We really are acting in a dishonorable way as a country at this point. I think there's still too many people who are just kind of like, well, we've been doing this for a long time. It seems to be working okay, be fine. But I think there's a big chunk of Americans, and I don't know if it's enough to change the atmosphere we have in the offices, to recognize that the way we've been doing business in the government is terrible. A good part of that is our monetary policy. We have a Federal Reserve System, which is a central bank, that essentially works privately for the good of themselves and their fellow cohorts in the banking business. And it's been a huge shift of wealth in this country to a select few. And this is not just in our country. We have select few all across the world that we're bailing out at this point. Further, what we really talked about is in the role of government. We've really got to the point where we are mandating and controlling the market such a degree that it, again, is suppressing the ability for people to freely enter and exit the market. Where it's the number one way to assure people are happy and successful is to have freedom. And we unfortunately have lost that concept in the past years. When we're voting, we've bought in that we need to select someone who's going to bring us benefits and give us advantage. If we can recognize that doing so has really brought to this point where we are into immediate's you know, relative term, sometime in the next years, economic class, because government's got bigger and bigger and has discouraged more and more people from the freedom of the marketplace, that we're in big time trouble. We really have to start returning to the idea that government is not the decider and the delegator and the benefit provider. They're there to be making sure the market's fair and that people aren't taking advantage. They're not being dishonest. They're not polluting their neighbor. I actually think we do a poor job in those areas, and we've gone off on stray things in rules and regulations that inhibit the marketplace and inhibit individuals' freedom, and I think we're suffering from it.
Hmm. Well, let me ask you real specific about, say, job creation, because, again, as unemployment is something that worries a lot of people. Is there something that you think the government should or could be doing to encourage job creation?
Really, everything I just listed. In other words, we have to reverse our course. We can't spend money we don't have. We can't have a bank that prints money up and distributes money at will, diluting all the rest of us' purchasing power. We need to return to the federal enumerated powers. And again, the whole list I'm giving here is not a flipping a switch type of thing. I'm not going to go in the office with other like-thinking people and we're going to have the problem fixed in no time. This is going to take decades to reverse because it's been building slowly over 100 years. But that is how the government can help, is not by getting so involved, being too proactive. That is causing the problem. It is not the solution.
Yeah. Well, if you think, and it sounds like what you're saying is you think that the government is too big, that it should be cut down in size. So that has to mean, if you think we're spending too much money, well, that has to mean we're going to have to, something that government is doing now, we're going to have to cut. So would you say, give me your top two or three things that the federal government does, some federal department, some activity, where you would say, I would just line that out. Is there anything like that?
I guess there's so much of the government involved, where there's no area where I wouldn't consider absolutely doing a freeze. But we can cut almost in any area you want. I think areas where you can find more consensus is probably our spending of money outside our country, whether it's military operations or foreign aid. I think that's an area where we're more likely to get consensus realization that we've done this over the top. We're bankrupt and we're spending $1 trillion a year overseas. We're acting like big shots when we aren't at this point. We actually have to put aside our hubris and pride in our country and realize that, you know, we've gotten into trouble and we need to do some corrections.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm assuming that you're talking about spending $1 trillion overseas. You're including the budget for the Pentagon. That has to include military spending, because
yes,
we're not spending $1 trillion in foreign aid.
Correct. I'm taking every time the federal government is spending money outside the border. So you're right. It's all encompassing when I use that $1 trillion figure. Yes.
Okay. Well, would you talk about the defense budget? Would you cut that?
Yes. I think we're at the point where we have to. In other words, we cannot be overbuilding our military to the sense where we're bankrupt and our money it becomes worthless. That'd be the same as if you dynamited your house to prevent a robber. Economically, that's the same type of thing you can do when you overreach. We could cut back on military spending, because I don't like the term of just defense spending, because we've definitely been offense spending also. Mm-hmm. I really think that we can reduce federal spending in military things by 25-30%, and we will still have the most powerful military in the world. And it's good to have a military when we need it, but we've gotten much too venturous with it, with nation building and trying to police the world. We can't afford it. Plus, I don't think it's a good idea. That's not the way to work with other people and other countries around the world.
Mm-hmm. That I would think that would mean, one of the things that would mean would be closing an awful lot of military bases that we have around the world and bringing those people home.
I guess I'd definitely say that's something to look at. Very strongly.
Hmm. You think there's no particular interest? We have no particular interest in contributing to the defense of Europe or the defense of Asia?
No, I really don't think that's the right approach, that we are the guardians and the policemen of the world. I think we need to work with other countries on that. We are not the only country of means to protect our own property. I think people also need to realize that if you're in your own country, you have a strong motivation to protect what you have. And the influence around the world has been riding, which is a very good thing. And we're not the big bubble in the world that we own that standard of living. It's much more widespread now, and I think all people around the world would love the chance to defend themselves. A right to protect themselves is universal for all humanity, and we don't have to be coming into countries like Germany or Japan or Korea, who are very well off, and telling them, well, we need to take care of your defense for you. Mm-hmm. It's not a good idea.
Do you think that it was a good idea for the United States to send troops into Iraq and Afghanistan?
I think after the Afghanistan being the base for al-Qaeda, when they had the attacks in this country, and I think it was illustrated by the success they were having coming over here, that we needed to disrupt their organization, and that apparently was based in Afghanistan. I think we should have done a better job of doing that and not get diverted off into other lands in the area. We should have declared war and been very aggressive to seek him out. I think 10 years was somewhat disappointing, that our fine military was spread out so thin that we couldn't get the job done. That was job number one. And essentially, we've gotten there after 10 years. I don't see any purpose for us to remain in the Middle East. They have a lot of problems figuring out that country, but who is best equipped for educating their people, discussing it, coming up solutions? It's the people in those lands. We essentially have put ourselves in the position of an interloper and an interferer, and that is not going to generate anything except for bad feelings against the United States.
You know, right now, I think that a lot of people think that the greatest threat in that region and maybe the greatest threat to the interest of the United States is Iran and the possibility that Iran would develop nuclear weapons. What do you think, if anything, we should do about Iran and its nuclear ambitions?
You know, this sounds deja vu. We already went this when we were talking about Iraq in the same language. We need to really be afraid of Saddam Hussein in Iraq. They're a huge threat to this country, and we found out that a lot of that was really poor intelligence, poor thinking, poor conclusions, way overreaction, and we're now seeing the same process in place. I'm kind of jaundiced, but my viewpoint is that we're seeing the effects of crony capitalism and the military-industrial complex and all the parties who have been making very good money off of warfare, propagandizing and abusing taxpayers for potentially another folly chase here. I really don't see strong evidence to back up, as you've properly said, is being run through the media over and over again. People have to remember a lot of media is owned by the crony capitalist. There is a prejudice in their reporting patterns, and you don't always get a nice, even, neutral viewpoint of the world if all you live and listen to is easy media.
Yeah. Well, just one further question, and I have a caller here we'll get to. With something like this, you can probably never be 100% sure, but let us suppose that we were as sure as we could be that Iran did, in fact, have a nuclear weapon. What then?
I think that we've probably been handling it the best we can all through the years of my life. In other words, I've grown up knowing that Russia had tens of thousands of nuclear warheads. Korea's had nuclear weapons for a number of years. Pakistan has them. India has them. Israel has them. The list of countries that have them have been around for a long time, and we have not gone nuts and said, oh my gosh, we need to immediately start an invasion of these countries because there's some bad people in these countries and we just can't do it. I mean, talk about bad people. You can't get any worse than what you see as far as the government of North Korea. So apparently our policy of not getting too involved and expecting military action when in another country has nuclear weapons is we've never had to do an immediate response, and I don't really see the huge difference here also. Do I like some of the elements I hear from Iran? No. But I also tell you that I'm impressed that you do hear elements that recognize that the officials they have running Iran, and this is from within the country, recognize there's a problem. I think there's a decent chance our government doesn't stick our finger and thumb too much in the work, that you will see the Arab Spring potentially correcting a lot of problems throughout the region. And our interference gums up the works. We need to have much more patience to let the process of human development in history to take place as it probably should. I don't have any doubt that the best form of freedom is going to rise to the top because it works the best. And I'm not saying it's going to happen quickly. It can be a bumpy road. And in this country, we're having a bump in freedom, in my case right now. But we are not the soothsayers with rifles can go over there and make them see the light and correct things. You really have to let people figure it out on their own. And I'm not saying that we don't need military defense. In other words, when we had the problem with Al-Qaeda in 2001, I think that's the time to pull the trigger and do something. But we've shot way past that.
Okay. We have a caller in Tolono. Let's talk with them. Line number one. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. Mm-hmm. I tuned in a little bit late, so if you covered this, I apologize. But which of the national Republican candidates for president do you agree with, or mostly agree with their philosophy, and then maybe how you differ from them? Thank you.
All right.
Well, the two candidates... Well, there's two that I've seen that really are out before the public right now that I like. I think would represent a change from the status quo we have right now, and when I say status quo, I'm talking both the Democrat and Republican parties have been putting in crony capitalist type supporters, big government type people. The two that I like the most are Ron Paul in the Republican primary, and I think Gary Johnson was a decent candidate in the Republican Party, and now I believe he's running Libertarian. But both of these gentlemen recognize that government's out of hand. We need to promote freedom, and those two really are wide and separate from the status quo, which I see other candidates. If you have one of those three in Republican primary, other than Ron Paul, as your favorites, you're going to really could keep voting for big government and the central bank controlling things, lots of warfare, more and more use of it to control the world. And I just think all those are we have to wake up that we are on a nosedive to mediocrity and no hope of coming out unless we realize that these themes have brought us to this point.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds as if you really yourself, I mean, you're running as a Republican, so Ron Paul is running as a Republican, but it sounds that you really resonate with the kind of ideas and the kind of thinking that you would likely find in the Libertarian Party.
The Libertarian Party has a lot of those values, but I've seen them in the Green Party. I've seen them in the Democrat Party. I've seen them in the Republican Party. And I think the strongest of the major parties has been the Republican Party for Libertarian type of ideas and pushing freedom and smaller government. But unfortunately, there's a strong element that you'll see in both major parties of crony capitalism. They want government to not let you decide things on your own. You need us to manage you. You need big corporations to make decisions. The amount of money we've handed over to the auto industry and nationwide unions at the expense of everybody else, that is the big government problem that I do not like in the Republican Party. I do not like in the Democrat Party. But the Republican Party does have the strong libertarian small government element in it. The parties will both be seeing a renaissance in the coming years. I don't think either are going to resemble what they are now because of the impending economic problems that we're going to have, which are going to get much worse no matter what we do. I think more and more people are going to come to realize that we have been doing the role of government improperly.
So you've talked about the problem of entrenched interests in politics. If you were elected, how long would you expect to serve?
My term's 2 years. I would expect to be in 2 years.
You would only serve one term?
I am not term limiting myself, even though I'm a person that thinks we should have term limits. I think the only way it makes sense to do term limits is if we put in the amendment, which was the only process that will ever change things. I would support it, but if there is no term limits, it doesn't make sense for people who believe in small government and term limits to voluntarily quit while the others who don't believe in those values continue on. It's just it doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
So I just want to make sure I understand. So is what you're saying is that would you were you to be elected, then you'd serve your 2 years, but then at that point you would leave it up to the people of the district whether they wanted you to continue, or would you say, okay, I've done my 2 years and I'm out?
I would think 2 years. I would likely want to run for another two terms, but would I want to after that? I really probably don't know enough for how successful and the entire process once you're getting there. I would tend to think not. I think there's a lot of really good people out there and that we shouldn't get locked into only one people that we christen as career politicians and the career politicians that represented us. I really think we should struggle to find people who are representative of our community. There's a certain amount, which I even found being on local boards, that if you're on a board too long, you end up identifying with the government process that you're supposed to be overseeing more than a person from looking from the outside. And I think it's really important for people, whether I'm running for my third or fourth term or as people are running now for decades of being in government, that's another sign of a problem when someone's been in office too long, that they won't have the representative perspective needed to make sure government's in a proper role.
Yeah. We're talking this morning in this hour with Mike Fersching. He's a candidate for Congress. He is one of three Republicans who will be competing in the March primary for the spot on the new 13th Congressional District ballot. We will talk some more with him after a very short break. This is Focus.
WILL programs are made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, whose MillerCom 2012 lecture series presents In Treatment, Psychiatry and the Archives of Modern Sexuality with Regina Kunzel on Thursday, March 8th at 4 p.m. in the Knight Auditorium at Spurlock Museum. More information is available at the Center for Advanced Study website.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you listening on WILL AM. And if you're watching through our website, we are webcasting this morning at WILL.illinois.edu. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. In the second hour today, the 11 o'clock hour, our guest is Adam Leshinsky. He's a senior editor at large for Fortune magazine, and we'll be talking about a book that he's written that looks at the corporate culture of Apple, the computer company. Inside Apple, How America's Most Admired and Secretive Company Really Works. That's the title of the book. He'll be joining us by phone in the second hour. Tomorrow morning, we'll have another candidate here, and this will be one of the Democrats who, and there are two, seeking to have their party spot on the ballot in this district, this new 13th district. David Gill will be the guest. He's a physician from Bloomington and has been a Democratic candidate for Congress before. He'll be with us here in the studio tomorrow. And then on the program on Tuesday, this is tomorrow, in the second hour, our guest will be Deborah Jacobs, a professor at Duke University, where she is associate professor of history, and we'll be talking about scholarship and research libraries and their global dimensions. She's here visiting the campus to give us a talk on that very subject. And there'll be a lot of other things this week as well. And, of course, questions and comments are always welcome. You can email us, you can call, and we're very happy to talk. This morning in this hour of Focus, as I said, our guest is Michael Fershing. He is a candidate for Congress in the new 13th Congressional District, one of three Republicans that will be on the ballot. Tim Johnson will also be on the ballot. He'll be here with us Thursday at 11. And then the third candidate is Frank Metzger, and he will be on the show Friday at 11. So you will have this opportunity to talk with all of them. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You can email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's another caller, someone in Urbana, here where we are, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. Did I hear you say that you felt it was important to restrict the power of large corporations?
Yes.
Well, if you reduce the power of government and you reduce regulation, doesn't that immediately increase the power of corporations?
Not if the government's in the proper role of regulating fraud, pollution, and economic coercion. If you're doing those things, you definitely are keeping the eyes on business, no matter if you're big or small. And no, I'm not saying laissez-faire. I'm saying that government has a small, limited role to make sure big corporations are behaving properly with the public.
Well, that requires regulation, doesn't it?
That is true.
It seems to me that there's a finite amount of power, and that if you reduce the power of the government, you automatically increase the power of other entities, including big business. And I just don't see how you can have small government and not have the nation run by corporations.
But what I would suggest to you that, you know, it's just not a balance between large corporations and government. You're forgetting one really important party to me, and that's the individuals. As individuals, we have a lot of power if it's not interfered with by corporations. But again, if we are monitoring for economic coercion, that's not going to happen. But government can also step in upon our individual choices also. In other words, let's say that, I don't know you, what you have, but let's say that you were really ticked off at a soap-making corporation and they cornered the market and bought out all the competitors and they made soap. Well, you as an individual can certainly say, I'm not going to buy their products. And I don't think you need government to come in here and make choices that we need to subsidize these other companies making soap. I think you as an individual can make a choice in the marketplace to change what's going on. And I think that's much more powerful and much more immediate than anything you do with the government.
I think you're completely missing the point that the power of the individual is through the government. And that
I just disagree with that concept.
You what?
I disagree with the concept you stated.
I think you have a very simplistic view of politics. if you reduce the power of government, you automatically increase the power of other entities. And the problem we're in right now is directly related to our having deregulated during the Clinton and Bush administrations. And you seem to be calling for more of the same.
Well, I'll just kind of sum up, because there definitely is a difference in worldview between yourself and I. But you essentially have bought in, which, again, this represents what we have today, is that it really is a battle between large groups and government. But what I believe is that it's not government supporting their pick for groups. It's government's protecting our individual rights, which is the role of government. And if we don't do that, if government's still in the power business of picking the most favored groups and the majority gets to pick who that is, we are going to continue to have troubles.
Well, the government doesn't seem to have been doing much of that. But I do have one other question. What is your stand on regulating contributions to elections and, in general, controlling the amount of money that's going into elections?
My basic belief on this is that I think it's perfectly good and probably a good idea to limit campaign contributions to individuals only. But I also can tell you that as a candidate, the amount of regulation you get as a candidate for keeping track of information is another weight which interferes with the ballot process. So there can be some problems with that. So I would support notions of candidates being limited to only getting contributions for individuals. But, you know, you get into another side issue, which is illustrated by the Citizen United case, which is a freedom of speech issue, is that can people outside of candidates get together and spend money to promote their own individual political views? I know there's been outcry saying that that's a really bad thing, that individuals can spend money to promote what they believe in. But I think it's a free speech thing. I think groups outside of candidates spending what they want to is a protection of freedom of speech. So I definitely don't want candidates directly receiving money from special interest. But I don't think we can do any way of preventing special interest from having their say separate from candidates without heavily stepping on the freedom of speech.
I want to thank the caller. We have another. This is also Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Morning.
Yes.
I guess I'd like to ask then, what are your stance on lobbyists and lobbying? What exactly do you think that, you know, when we're talking large businesses and corporations, we're also thinking about, you know, media conglomerates and, you know, people who have control of information. I'm just wondering what your take on all that is. Should that be left up entirely, you know, left, all things left entirely to the business, you know, except for perhaps whatever regulation you're talking about when it comes to, you know, I'm not sure, kind of overseeing these businesses and small government doing that as their job. I don't know. I just feel like it's a dangerous course to go down, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thanks.
Sure. It's definitely not a simple pat answer to the problem, but I'll give you my take on it. My take is that we're in a vicious circle right now, where in races such as my mind or as mine or other people in here, that candidates who cater towards lobbyists get the big donations. We have media. What I consider the crony media that reports heavily saying, well, this person has a lot more donations. I think they're more important. They're more of a valid candidate because they have a lot of money. Well, I think the public has to wise up to this. You'll find a strong correlation that the people have raised the most money is that they have the most ties to lobbyists. And I will put to you that if you are a person looking out for yourself, that that's the last person you want to put in office. But unfortunately, we're in a vicious circle right now where people rely on political advertising and getting more coverage by the crony media that they that's the people that they should consider voting for, and only people that kind should be vote for, and you have to pick some of the better evil of these kinds. Well, I put for you, we have to do a lot more work as we the people and find people who are going to protect us and not be catering to lobbyists. That is the only way off of this vicious circle we have right now. It's really people sticking up for themselves.
Okay. Well, I want to thank the callers. We have about 10 minutes left. Others can call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I want to ask you about some other areas. Let's talk about tax policy. How would you change federal tax policy?
Well, the tax policy is a quagmire. In other words, if anybody's watched the John Stossel show, for example, he does a good job illustrating where he'll plop down 65,000 pages of new regulations affecting the tax code in a year. The tax code is over 100,000 pages and whatnot. Well, this is utter failure of taxation. Taxation, in order to be fair, must be simple wherever we can understand it. It has to be clean and straightforward. Anybody who wants to tweak the system right now, and you hear a lot of proposals from various people who are in politics already, that we need to tweak the tax code this way or another. Again, that's pandering to special interests. It's not doing the wholesale change we need to do. I'd much prefer an approach where we're having a single deduction income tax code with only one deduction and getting rid of all these loopholes for everybody. I would like to see a huge reform on corporate code. Right now, corporations are treated as a separate entity, and I think that's been a bad idea. I think corporations should be just groups of people, just like anybody else, subject to all the other laws. And when a corporation makes money, the corporation doesn't get taxed. All the profits get divvied up amongst the stockholders, and those stockholders pay taxes on it just like anybody else who ran a small business or earned a wage. Those are the kind of things that will come up with a fair system if we simplify it and make the rules ubiquitous, where everyone is treated the same.
Okay. So it sounds like what you would do is your tax form would be, I made this much money, I get one exemption for myself.
Yes.
And then this is the rate, and this is what you pay. So
correct.
We have about five lines on it.
Right. And everyone knows that when everyone makes that next dollar, except for the people who are just getting started, who would get that deduction and be free. But anybody who's already got what we consider to be the basic plateau of having a reasonable wage, then any dollar you make at that point is the same. Everybody has to pay it, and there's no way of getting out of it. I think that's a fair system. It's fair competition. It's a fair market, and I think that's the best way to bring prosperity and fairness to this country.
All right. Let's talk with some other folks here. Let's go to Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
You might have defined this early on in the program, and I missed it, but you were talking about crony capitalism, and then you started talking about crony media. And I don't know exactly what you mean by crony capitalism. Do you mean corporatism and corporations being protected by the state, which is actually fascism? But, what do you mean?
Yeah, the crony capitalism does encompass to the terms that you just used. Corporatism definitely is another way of describing the situation we have now. Fascism, where the state and the businesses is closely linked together. Crony capitalism definitely is where government is showing favoritism in the marketplace to one business entity over another, and we're doing that infinitum right now.
So would you say that we have a form of fascism?
Yeah, there's fascist elements in our country right now. It's one of those areas where, in other words, let's say you bring up the term socialism. Are we a socialist state? No, we're not a socialist state. Do we have a lot of socialism in this country? Yes. We have a lot of fascism showing up in the country? Yes. There are all these elements that should, to me, be warning sign if you're a person who thinks individuals and freedom are really important. Those type of situations with government should be, you know, that your ears should be pricked up saying, okay, we better be treading really lightly in this category. We as a people haven't been doing that. We've been kind of turning our backs to these attacks on freedom, and crony capitalism is the result we have right now.
Thank you.
All right. Give me an example of fascism in America today.
Well, I would say anybody who got a bailout is illustrating fascism. In other words, the government essentially owns part of that business because they've contributed heavily to the operations of it. That the banking industry with TARP is a good example. If you look at the domestic auto dealers such as GM, who have received multi-billions from the country, that is fascism, where government is deciding which company is going to get an assist at taxpayer cents. There's plenty of car companies who are doing well and producing good products who did not get this favorite treatment from the government. It's a severe infringement on the market.
So you would think it would have been better just to let GM go out of business if that was what was going to happen.
That's the way the market works. In other words, I'm a businessman. If I cannot provide a good service in my veterinary practice and my competitors do a better job or they do it for a better price, I'm going to go bankrupt. I don't think we want to have that where someone starts a business and does a poor job. They're entitled to being bailed out. Oh, I did a poor job. You need to subsidize me. I think that on its face of it is ridiculous, but that's what we've done.
So I also have another email here from somebody who was, again, really interested in having you define your terms a little bit. And, for example, would like to know, can you give some examples of crony capitalists that you know have influenced government?
I guess there's a lot of examples. I guess the most egregious would probably be in the monetary side. If you look at things such as Countrywide Finances, Fannie and Freddie Mae, and the banking industry in general, AIG, Goldman Sachs, these are all people who essentially took risk in the market and knew they didn't have any risk. They knew that if these gambles paid off, they were going to make a ton of money. But if they took these gambles and failed, well, they had all their inside government people who were going to make them whole again. That's just a humongous example. Mm-hmm. But it can be more minor things. It can be putting regulations on businesses that limit the entry for competition against the businesses already established. And we have numerous examples of that. We have that just I mentioned here about the running as a candidate. We've put in more and more layers of legal steps for someone to get on the ballot, and that certainly helps the parties who are in control, and it sure discourages people who want to run on their own because they don't want to be controlled by these special interest parties. That's just two areas of examples.
Mm. What the caller here or the person who sent the email would like to know, what perks could a newly elected congressman do without to reduce government spending?
Big areas to me is that I don't think there should be any retirement benefits for elected officials. They make decent salaries. If you can't figure out how to run your own retirement off of in my position, $175,000 a year, if I can't figure out how to set some of that aside for the future, I definitely should not be your representative in Congress. They have all these huge perks of getting more and more remunerations and compensations beyond that. It's unnecessary, unneeded. That'd be one area. But I probably don't know all the perks that are available as much as the outside as I will in the future. But you can see what my attitude is towards such things.
Would you make any changes to the Social Security system?
Yes. The first thing I would do is I make it voluntary. If this is a good retirement system and you're a person who can run their life on their own, there's no reason why you should be mandated to join it. Also, people, you know, the term Ponzi scheme's been laid on it. It's kind of controversial. Well, Ponzi schemes are where the profits of an investment are totally dependent on people in the future also doing an investment. Well, you know, that's what we've done with Social Security. It's unfunded. We are promising people money, and there's no money there unless more people contribute. So now we're saying, yes, you have to contribute. But we still are promising more money than we have. This is kind of like we're wrenching Social Security, but this is the tip of iceberg of a huge problem that we probably need an amendment on, saying the government can no longer promise benefits that are unfunded. The state of Illinois, which is not what I'm running for, is a huge example where we have $85 billion that we are unfunded benefits that we've promised by government, and there's no money for it. Well, so Social Security was, you know, the original one, but that's another example where we've done that, and that is just a poor structure for government.
Mm-hmm. It seems though, Social Security, you're going up against what it seems to be one of the maybe the single most popular thing the federal government has ever done.
Well, also I'm talking these strange languages, but I can also tell you I recognize that this this is solidly entrenched within our psyche. People depend on it. We are not going to break down the Social Security system in a short period of time. I think it's going to be a process. There's tons of people who are retired or going to retire soon that we cannot pull the rug out from them. But we have to be taking steps towards correcting this, which is so unsound in how it's structured.
All right. Let's get at least one more caller here. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yes. Your guest was talking about crony capitalists. Would you consider the Koch brothers such?
Yeah, they're people who throw their economic weight around quite a bit. I guess I don't know all their dealings. A certain amount of them they're throwing their weight around is in the private sector, but I definitely see examples with media, for example, where they're controlling a lot of media and using regulations to make sure they stay in control. So some parts of them isn't crony, but definitely the processes of their business are.
We're coming down to it. We have about a minute. I want to ask you just in that time if there's anything in particular in the terms of agricultural policy that you'd want to talk about.
I have a fairly decent agriculture background. My mom's parents are in the cattle business out in Nevada, and I worked out in the ranch for years. And I'm in the veterinary business where I work with agriculture people in my neighborhood. I like doing the large animal work when I get a chance, even though I had one last week, which was disastrous with a dead calf. But that happens. You do the best you can. Agriculture has a huge Department of Agriculture, which I think has become bloated. I think we've gone too far in agriculture regulation. I would like to see areas where there's less interference with the Department of Commerce between producers of agriculture products and the market in foreign lands. I think it should be really opened up where people can more directly find buyers for their product and open that market up with far less oversight. Generally work towards less and less regulation and making the markets more free is what I would like to see in agriculture, just like any other area.
Well, we're going to have to stop because we here come to the end of the time. Our guest, Mike Fershing, is a candidate for Congress in the new 13th Congressional District. There are three Republicans. They'll be competing with Tim Johnson and Frank Metzger. They'll be on the show later this week, so you'll have the opportunity to talk with them. And if you're interested in finding out more about our guest, his website is MikeFershingForCongress.com.
I'm on Facebook, too, Mike Fershing for Congress, where you'll hear a lot of my ideas. If you want to learn some more, it's a decent place.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Rancho. It was fun